Hi, guys. Welcome back to the Simple Living Made Simple podcast. I am so excited for my guest today because she is one of my favorite homesteading people to follow and get content from and resources from. And she has just released a book. So I'm so excited to talk with her about this book today. Her name is Angela Ferraro Fanning from the Axe and Root Homestead. And she just released her book called The Sustainable Homestead. And we're going to talk about it. So thank you so much, Angela, for joining me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So like I said, you're like one of my favorite people to follow. You're just like very thorough and you have tons of just really knowledgeable content that you can tell that you've been doing this for a really long time. And that's obviously evident in this beautiful book. So can you tell me a little bit about yourself and your homestead and your business and why you chose this lifestyle?
Yeah. So, well, first of all, thank you for that very sweet and kind introduction. That's very flattering. So I am located in central New Jersey on a 6-acre property that was a farm in 1775, and it had animals for a while. And then in the 1950s, the last animals that really sort of took over the land here were cattle, and it was just kind of fallow after that. And I think it was home to some chickens and some cats, but you know, the farm had gotten split off and it really just needed somebody to come in and kind of give it some love and revive it and put nutrients back in the soil. Simultaneously, I've always had an interest in gardening, both ornamental and vegetable gardening. But then after I had my first child, I really just wanted to feel a deeper connection with the earth and kind of get out of the rat race. My neighbors didn't really like that we were bringing in ducks into the 3-quarter acre property that we had. And I was trying to grow food in every inch that I could, and we needed to find a new home. And so we ended up at the 1775 property we have now. And it was just kind of this fit, this marriage of the right circumstances that aligned together that I was happy to jump in with permaculture practices and bring this place back to life. And I am just very fortunate to sort of be the next one in line to foster or facilitate the health of the land that I have now.
I love that outlook. I love the outlook of fostering your land and being a steward of the land. You know, that's not something that you kind of think about all the time. You kind of just want to garden for the product, but to actually like develop and nurture the land, it's like something really special.
Thanks.
And that is the kind of the focus of your book, is that and your lifestyle is permaculture. And for those of you that don't know what that is, could you explain to us what that means?
Yeah, absolutely. So we hear a lot of buzzwords in the homesteading world, right? We hear regenerative agriculture, we hear permaculture, and really the intention is the same. We're all trying to give more back to the land than what we're taking from it. You know, we hear all these problems right now about soils being depleted of nutrients, and food contains the least amount of nutrients that it's ever had. Well, permaculture, what really makes that facet of regenerative agriculture or sort of sustainable farming unique is that everything that I do is in mimicry of Mother Nature. This is not something I invented. This practice has been around for centuries, practiced by a lot of different cultures, but it's not common or mainstream in the United States because it takes a long time. It's not instant gratification. It's not, you know, this sort of overnight yield or one season yield. And so instead of placing emphasis on annual crops, I'm doing perennials because they come back every year. Or I'm thinking about animals and thinking, how can I bring something in that's actually going to perform a job for me other than just being like really cute? So everything that I'm doing is in mimicry of Mother Nature to create an ecosystem out of my farm.
That's amazing. That's
cool.
Kind of sounds overwhelming though, which is why I really love this book, because it kind of serves as like a blueprint in like transforming your property to like a thriving homestead. Could you kind of like walk me through? Because I know when you were in the book, you lay out how when you bought your property, it was kind of desolate and you had to kind of start from scratch. Could you kind of walk us through that process a little bit and what that looks like?
Yeah. So what worked for me isn't necessarily going to work for everyone, right? Because the whole point of permaculture and mimicking Mother Nature is to do what's already sort of working and functioning naturally in your microclimate. So when you get a property, the best thing that you can really do is sort of assess for a while and take note of, okay, yes, how much sun do I get in this location? Is there any sort of deterrence to the amount of sun, like trees, you know, is water pool? Am I experiencing flooding? So it becomes this little bit of an observational period where you're just gathering information. And of course, when I moved in, I'm impatient and I wanted to hit the ground running and my soil was just crap and I was frustrated. But, you know, I learned a lot of lessons, and patience is one of them. It's you can't achieve permaculture status overnight. It's a combination of plants and animals working together and finding what works in your zone, but also like what works in your specific soil type. Like, what kind of soil do you have? And it can be overwhelming if you're trying to accomplish it all at once. But if you start looking at pieces and saying, okay, I want chickens, for example, what can chickens do for me besides give me eggs? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I really want something that's going to be superior for meat, eggs, but also tilling the ground. And you start kind of researching every single thing that you bring in, not just animals, but plants too. It really starts to come together.
Mm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, definitely. And I think that kind of gives into my next question, actually, is that I think people that are kind of drawn to this are like go-getters, overachievers, people that want to learn everything now. So what like would be a realistic timeline if you're trying to transform a rundown property to a thriving homestead?
If you can harness your patience and observe for a bit, you're going to do yourself a lot of good.
Yeah.
But then I would start with taking a soil test, running soil samples, learning the nuances of your already existing ecosystem. And that doesn't just include rainfall and sun and soil. It also includes, okay, what animals already live there, right? So we tend to think of farm ecosystems as the animals that we're solely bringing in. But I already have, owls that are going to help with the rodent population. So I don't need an abundance of barn cats. I have owls. And so I'm putting up owl houses to encourage them to stay. Mm-hmm. And so it's really just sort of, after you get into the assessment part, it's saying, okay, where do I want to start? Is my priority with animals or is my priority with food? And then saying, okay, maybe it is with food. I'm going to put in some crops. Can I put in a crop that's going to come back every single year, a perennial? Because there's such things as perennial broccoli. There's perennial tomatoes or tomatillos. You know, there's things that we don't see at the grocery store. And then it's sort of saying, okay, now that I have this established, what do I need to help facilitate the health of that? One thing that people kind of are trained to do is if they have a pest problem, is they think, I gotta get rid of these pests. Mm-hmm. But wait a second, maybe that's really the answer. What are you missing on your farm that should be taking care of those pests for you? And then it's not a problem. Now you've created a food supply for a helper. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. That's great. That's just a really awesome way of looking at it. And I just love how it's a whole umbrella of like bringing your whole property together and making it all work together rather than just saying, all right, here's my garden that produces food. Here's my chicken coop. They have eggs. But making it all work together. It's really beautiful. And I think that, you know,
nothing should be in isolation when you're looking at a permaculture setup.
That's cool. So I know that just like myself, and there's many other that have like a dream of owning like a small farmette, to provide food and all that stability for their family. It can be like a romantic ideal, right? Of like that a lot of people have. Could you tell me some of the struggles you had when choosing your ideal property?
You know, it's interesting because we moved from our 3/4-acre property kind of in a rush. Mm-hmm. We were looking to get out quickly. So I didn't do this years-long search that some people have the luxury of doing to find the right farm. And I'll tell you what, there's a lot of things about my property that I wish were different. We have horrible floods, horrible flooding issues. And we're not just talking about pooling water. I'm talking about rushing 3 feet of water that is damaging and ruins everything in its path. But what I have come to find is that there really is no such thing as a perfect property. Mm-hmm. When choosing a site, I'm looking at something that's going to be conducive to growing food. Obviously, I'm not going to buy a property that's full of rock, right? Yeah. I'm going to keep in mind whether or not I need housing for animals and what's that look like. Do I need to build a barn? Does it already have something? You know, I didn't start with a horse stable. I converted a 3-car garage into my horse stable. So there's definitely, I think there's no such thing as an ideal property. I think we have to be realistic. And we also have to understand that when it comes to sort of working with what you have, you can make a lot of so-called problems actually work in your favor. I can find ways to capture floodwater. I can find ways to harness excess moisture for later use in the dry seasons. I think it's more about working with what you have than seeking out something ideal.
Yeah, makes sense. Are there any must-haves that you do think, like access to water or anything like that, that you definitely have to?
I mean, having access to water is going to be essential for livestock and crops. Yeah. But even if you don't have, you know, quote unquote, proper irrigation, mm-hmm. and if you live in a wet climate, you can harvest water from rooftops. There's ways to bring it in rain barrels. So I think the biggest thing is just go into property ownership, if you're not already there, with the idea that, number one, yes, things can be manipulated, but not necessarily replaced. So if you are not crazy about living on top of a lot of exposed bedrock in the soil, because there isn't really any soil, that's a problem if your intention is to grow crops. You really should kind of know ahead of time what your goals are for the site.
Gotcha. That's good. So kind of setting your goals is a good way to start. And that's what I really love about this book, is that it, like I said before, is kind of like a blueprint, but it also is like broken down into different sections. And I think one of the most valuable, in my opinion, is your detailed chapter about how to incorporate animals into your homestead, because the whole pasture, fencing, housing aspect of animals really kind of overwhelms me, and I'm sure other people. Could you tell me a little bit about that process of incorporating animals into your farm?
Sure. So I think we started with ducks, and after I sort of had my garden spaces established, I did ducks because I don't really like chickens. But the reason I don't like chickens is because they tend to really scratch up a lot of forage and growth. Mm-hmm. And knowing that eventually I was going to be bringing in larger livestock, that wasn't going to be a good fit for me. I didn't want to have to worry about over tillage of grazing spaces. I also didn't really want to worry about trying to find a way to keep chickens out of my gardens. Mm-hmm. So with ducks, the domesticated breeds don't fly, with the exception of Muscovies. So I didn't have to worry about the flying bit, and their webbed feet don't scratch.
Okay.
The reason I'm using this as my example is because, one, we started small with animals, so we could learn the sort of ins and outs of, okay, do we really want to take on this responsibility? It's a lot different than having a garden or even a dog. Yeah. But number two, what's it going to be like to create extra housing? What's it going to be like to make sure that we are in and out cleaning litter regularly? What are we going to do with that used bedding? And sort of getting in this pattern of, can we really use waste? And how are we going to be able to successfully and healthily maintain these animals? Mm-hmm. When we moved to our new property then, I had always wanted horses. And so when we did look for this land, I did look for something that was going to be conducive to grazing large livestock. But I didn't want to just pick out an animal that I could just ride. I knew that with any horse, obviously you can compost the manure, but what if I could take it a step further? What if I could use draft horses and have them pull for me? We don't till. I'm a no-till farmer, so I don't want to use the word and say till for me, because I'm not tearing up the soil, but they pull weight. They bring in harvest. They help spread manure in the pastures. And so then we began doubling up, right? We were stacking the functions these animals provide. So then I learned this really cool thing. Sheep ingest parasites while they're grazing in the fields. After they go through, the horses have already been there. They ingest the parasites and the parasites die. And it breaks the life cycle of parasites that infect horses. And I was like, wait a second. So if I got sheep, I could potentially have to deworm my horses less. Does that work for the sheep too? And sure enough, it's a dead end host thing. As the horses graze, they're ingesting parasites that infect sheep and they break the life cycle. And it's like, well, now I need sheep. So,
right.
So every time I bring something in, it's due to research. I have definitely fallen prey to what a lot of farms experience, is having animals dumped here that can't find another home. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I don't bring anything into the farm that can't perform a job for me that somebody else isn't already doing, because then you open your things up to too many parasites, overgrazing, and really it does require a balance.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there's a lot of research and a lot of planning that goes into at least what you do before you compulsively buy animals or something.
It's like true. That. It's a thoughtful integration, if yeah. you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really good. I think that's probably something that, yeah, I could learn a little bit about, because I definitely jump, I don't know, dive with both feet or whatever, dive head first. I don't know what I do, but so yeah, so it takes a lot of planning. So that kind of segues into my next question. How do you work with the seasonality? Do you kind of sit down and map out like a yearly plan, or are you just kind of have it now in your head and the rhythms of it?
I wish I could say that I had some sort of concrete written out plan. The truth though, is every single year that I homestead, I learn something different and then mm-hmm. it ends up tweaking that plan a little bit.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to say it's always changing. It's more just constantly evolving for the better mm-hmm. as we learn and as we experience, right?
Yeah.
With regard to the pastures, for example, I just finished seeding my cover crops that my animals graze on. I don't just do grass. Mm-hmm. So I just finished that. And then I know that come probably June, I'm going to do another pass of seed. And then I'm going to do another one for fall cover crops around August or September. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the seasonality of planting forage for the animals. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we tap our trees for sap. So that's going to be happening in December and January where I live, which is central New Jersey. We don't wait to tap trees until March, like Vermont, because we have a different season.
Yeah.
Then I also know that, okay, as soon as I'm done tapping trees, that's when I start to shift into garden planting season. And so the first things to get planted are onions, because they take the longest. And I start those from seeds in trays. And that takes place already in January. And then in February in my greenhouse, I'm starting seeds for cold loving crops. And those get transplanted out come March and April into the garden or into the hoop houses. You know, and then just like any other gardener, you know what's going to need to be started from seed for your hot season crops, like your peppers and tomatoes. And so, of course, there's this whole life cycle of the garden. And I grow spring, I grow summer, fall, and then winter in the greenhouse or hoop house. Mm-hmm. And then with regards to the animals, we obviously just have our different routines for them. Different times that the stables need to get cleaned out. Obviously, dirty bedding is removed regularly all year long, but we're talking like deep clean. Mm-hmm. There's when the cover crop is established in my pastures, that's when the animals get turned out. So there is a lot of connection to nature mm-hmm. and there is a lot of repetition.
Yeah. And that probably comes from years of just setting into a rhythm of how it all works.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And I think that kind of makes it not easier, but a little bit more manageable, because you're not doing everything at one time. It's kind of like laid out through the year and kind of works all together. That was kind of one of the hardest things for me to get, even with just gardening, was how, you know.
Well, that's one of the huge perks about planting the perennials over annual crops, right? Is they're already planted. And mm-hmm. so really it's just sort of then maintenance. I'm trying to free myself of a lot of that, oh my God, it's spring planting time, that rush.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I know that asparagus, artichokes, apples, rhubarb, I know it's all going to be coming up, you know, and so that frees me up from that labor.
Right. And that you have a really awesome chapter in here about the sustainable orchard, which is really cool, because something that is also kind of intimidating in my opinion, just because it kind of seems so permanent for some reason, you know, planting an orchard. What do you have at your homestead?
A lot of diversity. So because my homestead is so old, when I moved in, I had these massive pear, apple, and cherry trees. But wow. I mean, they are hundreds of years old. Mm-hmm. So we're at the point where we aren't getting much fruit off of them anymore. That was such a bummer to me. So of course, I brought in a ton of saplings, and it's going to take a while. We're just trickling in a little bit of fruit here and there. I've got mulberries, apricots, quince, persimmon, medlar fruit, apples, pears, peaches, nectarines. I mean, I've got everything from the common orchard fruits like cherries to the things like the medlars that are a little bit more unheard of. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I diversify so much isn't just to have like a wide palate for the mm-hmm. kitchen, but it's more like if there's a bad pest season, I am not losing all of my crop. I would not want to plant all apple trees. And if we had really bad coddling moth that year, I don't want to wipe out all my yield all at once. Mm-hmm. So to have different things, I have sort of an insurance policy that I have food coming in, but also right. things ripen at a different time. So there's always right. an abundance of food.
Yeah. So you're also working with that seasonality of the mm-hmm. fruit and having fresh fruit all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really cool. So I know that being a homesteader and being self-sufficient takes and requires a certain level of discipline, and just kind of talking to you today and looking through this, it's clear like you have that. Well, can you tell me what that looks like for you?
You know, I think that for me, this lifestyle is such a passion that it's my hobby. Yeah. And I am fortunate enough to get to do it as my job full time, you know, mm-hmm. and really for me, it's just sort of about, it's easy to get overwhelmed. Just like when people say, if you buy a house, it's going to own you. Oh, just wait till you own a farm or a homestead. That will own you.
Right.
So you really have to create, or at least I do, a schedule that is manageable. So that means in the morning, I'm the first one up. I go out and I give everybody breakfast on the farm. And then I come in and I give everybody breakfast in the house and I pack lunches. The kids go off to school and their school day is my work day. And so when they get off the bus or I pick them up, that is when I really aim to be done with my farm projects for the day. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a fair amount of time. That's like 6-7 hours a day that I get to do chores, plant, and that sort of thing. And usually by the end of that 7-hour window, I'm pretty exhausted anyway, physically. Right. And then it allows me to be on for them when they get home. You know, mm-hmm. that's when we're doing homework, we're hanging outside, we're making dinner. And it was definitely an interesting challenge to try throwing a book into the mix like The Sustainable Homestead, because that's something I needed to really find time for. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, it got done and I was passionate about doing it. I think it's just about setting realistic expectations and giving yourself grace, because we can't do it all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. But that's really good. I love to hear people's kind of routines a little bit when they have all these duties that they're responsible for and how they actually make it all work. And all right. Uh-huh. So I always ask people this question: what new homesteading skills are you learning right now? Because this is all a lifelong learning process. So what are you working on now?
So actually I've gone to school to get a certificate in permaculture. Mm-hmm. All of my knowledge has been acquired through self-education, and I used to call it holistic homesteading. I didn't know the phrase permaculture was a thing until a couple of years ago. So long story short, I found that Cornell has continuing education that's open to anyone. It's not like,
okay,
it's not like a prestigious application process. It's not snotty. Oh, Cornell. It's like mm-hmm. anyone can do this as long right. as you pay for it. So I'm just going online and I'm in my last session right now. And I really like it. I will be getting a certificate in permaculture very soon.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
is there a
thank
lot
you.
That you're learning that you didn't already come across?
I mean, I
maybe it's just more formally like,
you know what it is. There was a lot of gaps for me where I had specifically wanted to know something. And so I would go research that specific thing. Yeah. Right. And so all of this knowledge sort of came together bit by bit. It was mm-hmm. like an isolated learning brought back to this sort of main portfolio of knowledge. Now it's kind of nice to be able to weave it all together a little bit yeah. more. Yeah. Obviously I don't know it all. I will never know it all. But I am thankful and grateful that I didn't just learn a whole bunch of bullshit and run with it. And now I'm like relearning everything. Like it yeah. shows me that, okay, I was on the right path, you know?
Right. Well, that's validating. Yeah. That's good.
Yeah, it's good.
And then it's just because you just wrote a book about it, it's probably.
Yes, seriously.
All right. So where can my audience find you?
Yeah. So I'm very active on Instagram, YouTube, and a little bit on TikTok. My handle on everything across the board is AXE, AXE, and AND, root Homestead. So axandroothomestead.com is my website and blog. You can look me up on those social media outlets. And then I also have a podcast with a co-host called Homestead Education. And we just sort of chat both logistical and resourceful homesteading information, but also the real stuff that nobody talks about, like dealing with losing an animal and what that feels like and that sort of thing.
Right. Okay, great. Well, I want to figure it out. I'll include all links in the show notes and everything. So thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it so much.
All right. Don't forget to go check out the Sustainable Homestead ready for pre-order now and set to release on March 28th, 2003.